At the beginning of modernity, as we all know, can be dated in relation to the phenomenon, the history of which we wish to trace. The attempt to fix the time and the position of the rabbis, the official bearers of the halakhic authority, changed, eliciting as a result an alteration in the outlook as well, may well be facilitated by observations of two corresponding processes. One of these was the growing intervention of the respective governments in the affairs of the Jewish communities, undermining the autonomy upon which the authority of the rabbis depended. The other was the emergence of a group of people within the community who, relying on their own judgment, contested the prerogative of the rabbis to control the religious conduct of their congregants. The two phenomena are not independent of each other. The tendency of the modern state to appropriate functions formerly the domain of religious institutions and the endeavor of the individuals to exempt themselves from religious authority are both an expression of the expanding spirit of rationalism in the course of the 18th century. This trend may have affected the life of the Jewish communities in the West from their very start. A tangible and irreversible impact upon them, however, occurred only in the last decade of that century. In a recent Hebrew article, I had the opportunity of showing how these two factors intervened in the history of the twin community of Altona Hamburg, as well as in the life of its rabbi, Raphael Cohen. Altona belonged to Denmark, the royal government of which continued to grant the Jewish community the autonomy it desired up to the 1780s, while in most other Western countries the enforcement in instrument of Jewish self-government, the Ban, the Harem, had already been curtailed or entirely abolished. Rabbi Cohen, of Lithuanian origin, was elected to this important rabbinic post in 1775, and at that time he could still exercise the rabbinical functions of administering justice according to Talmudic law and supervising the adherence of his congregants to religious norms. But in 1781, one member of the community, Nathanael Posner by name, who lived in Hamburg but was under the jurisdiction of the Altona Rabbinate because he enjoyed the protection of the Danish king, refused to appear before the rabbi's court. He added to his disobedience a disregard for certain religious customs, and he publicly mocked the entire rabbinical tradition on which the life of the community rested. The rabbi, with the consent of the community's wardens, threatened the recalcitrant man with a harem unless he repented. Yet, the case being submitted to the Danish government, it ended in a restriction of the rabbi's right to impose the so-called Great Ban without the previous consent of the state. It is evident from the relevant historical sources that the decision of the Danish authorities was influenced by the fact that the clash between the rabbi and his congregants had gained publicity, and public opinion clearly tended towards abolishing religious compulsion of any kind. This view was explicitly maintained by Moses Mendelssohn, who happened to evolve his well-known theory about the relationship between state and religion exactly at this juncture. According to Mendelssohn, religion should forego any means of coercion. If Jewish communities and their rabbis resorted to the bench as a means of discipline, they would be acting in opposition to the genuine teachings of Judaism. So Mendelssohn. This was the time of the French Revolution and the dissolution of the established fabric of society. Mendelssohn's views gained more and more currency, lending support to the rejection of rabbinical authority by recalcitrant members of the community. Rabbi Cohen in Altona lived to see his capacity to enforce the law dissipate without, however, conceding the ideological claim on which this development was based. He still adhered to his avowed principle that the enforcement of the law is a basic tenet of Judaism. In a public sermon not long before his death in 1803, he declared, and I am quoting, "Whoever bears the name of an Israelite and who retains his reason unspoiled by the influence of heretic ideas knows that it is a fundament of the entire Torah and the commandments to compel and penalize transgressors of a divine prohibition and compel the fulfillment of a positive commandment. Whoever has ever beheld the light of the Torah knows that the foundation of the Torah is built upon this compulsion, and nobody would deny this truth except those who would deny the sun at midday." End of quotation. There is no doubt that historically Rabbi Cohen was right. The traditionally accepted conception was that the community was not only entitled, but obligated to enforce the law by all means at its disposal. No wonder, therefore, that those who clung to the halakha in its entirety, like Raphael Cohen, gave up the notion of compulsion only in yielding to external circumstances. To the extent that they were in possession of means of coercion, they did not hesitate to employ them. This sentiment was voiced as clearly as possible by the successors of Rabbi Cohen in Hamburg, who initiated the controversy over the Reformed Temple in 1819. At that time, Hamburg had no chief rabbi. The function of that office were being carried out by a court of three. It was in their name that a circular letter was sent out to the outstanding rabbis of the time, asking their considered opinion concerning the innovations introduced in the temple. The purpose of the letter was to evoke replies of condemnation, which would force the town senate to support the rabbinical court in its endeavor to forbid the functioning of the newly built temple. The circular letter begins with a laudatory statement about the majority of the Hamburg community as God-fearing and observant. But then it goes on to say, and I am quoting, "Despite this, it is now many years since the plague of heresy began among some of the leading rich people who brazenly transgressed God's commandment and publicly desecrate the Sabbath, and we are unable to stop them. Atkan. The rabbis thus conceded that they were powerless as far as the religious conduct of those people was concerned, since they lacked a means of compulsion. Still, concerning the emerging issue of the temple, they did vow that the Senate would be induced to act against the deviators. On what this hope rested, we shall see later. First, let us consider another issue, that of circumcision, for which the support of the non-Jewish authorities continues to be at the disposal of the rabbis. The first instance documenting the situation comes once again from Hamburg. The Hamburg Municipality Archive contained documents about the clash in 1805, that is before the temple's clash, between the rabbinate and a man, member Joseph Heller by name, who despite repeated warning from the community, refused to circumcise his newborn son. Heller dismissed the community's warning, arguing that the circumcision was a matter of religion and that compliance should hence be left to the individual. In this view, however, turned out not to be shared by the Hamburg Senate. So other religious observances were left to the discretion of the individual. Circumcision was an exception. This religious rite was seen as having the same function for a Jew as baptism for a Christian, namely, initiation into the religious community. Clearly, the Senate still continued to demand that everyone belonging to a religious community, that everyone belonged to a religious community. Religious education and affiliation were still regarded as the only guarantee of political loyalty as well as juridical reliability. The Hamburg Senate accordingly rejected the reluctant father's appeal in the name of religious liberty. Faced by the Senate's support of the rabbinate's demand, the father extricated himself from the situation by baptizing his son instead of circumcising him. We have it on the authority of contemporaries that the insistence of the communities on circumcision as an unremittable condition for registering a child as a Jew induced hesitant parents to follow the example of Mendel Joseph Heller in Hamburg and turn their children over to Christianity. Until the early 40s of the 19th century, support of the rabbinate's demand by the non-Jewish authorities seems to have been universal in the Western European states, much to the chagrin of the secularized Jewish intellectuals. The much publicized association of the Reformfreunde in Frankfurt in 1842 indeed singled out circumcision in its proclamation as, I quote, not binding as a religious act or as a symbol. At about that time, as it happened, it seemed that the Frankfurt Senate might regard circumcision as a voluntary act only. This impression arose from the text of an ordinance published by the Health Department of the Senate, obliging Jewish parents to observe certain hygienic precautions when circumcising their sons. The act itself, then, seemed to be left to the discretion of those concerned. one of the members of the community, seizing upon this interpretation, refused to circumcise his son, yet still demanded that the child be registered in the community records as a Jew. The Orthodox regarded this request as nothing less than a scandal, inducing the aged rabbi Solomon Abraham Trier to appeal to the Senate for clarification that the time-honored condition for membership in the Jewish community, circumcision, was still in force. At the same time, a circular letter was sent out in the rabbi's name to a great number of his colleagues all over Germany and Italy, asking for confirmation of the halakhic decision which he had submitted to the Senate. The decision states, I quote, that circumcision is a holy and eternal symbol of the covenant, and that the obligation to circumcise the newborn rests not only on the father, but on the Jewish community, and that the Israelite who persists in his resistance, refusing to circumcise his son out of unbelief and denial of the revealed law, thus essentially renounces his membership in the community and therefore may not be admitted either to testify as a witness or to take the moral judaical oath. End of quotation. This is the German version of the circular letter. The original Hebrew version adheres more closely to the traditional terms, using, for example, the term Beit Din instead of the community as the agency that would act instead of the father if the father doesn't fulfill his duty. Still, it is the German version that is more revealing, for using the term moral judaico, it indicates an intention to disqualify the reluctant father from serving as a witness or taking an oath before a non-Jewish court. This ruling of the Frankfurt rabbi and the responses he received from his colleagues are a revealing document, reflecting the position of the rabbi at this juncture, rabbis at this juncture, as well as their outlook, which, as we shall see, was by then far from unanimous. That Rabbi Trier, and not only he, but also his two younger colleagues, Bear Adler Cohen and Aaron Fuld, who sent out the scriptural letter in his name, could believe in the continuing support of the non-Jewish authorities regarding circumcision, shows how strongly the traditional-minded halakhis clung to the inherited notions of the past. Even stranger is the fact that they wish to use the invocation of the special Jewish oath of Mora Judaico, a practice very much resented by the Jewish public and which indeed was being abolished by state after state under the impact of enlightened public opinion. And but still they adhere to it as a means of coercion. Still, the Frankfurt rabbis were by no means the only ones harboring such sentiments. Rabbi Seligman Ber Bamberger went even farther, recommending an appeal to the state authorities to use physical force against the reluctant father. The state could not remain indifferent, so Bamberger argued, in the face of the danger arising from the presence of people having no religious whatsoever. Bamberger was alone in his request for an expectation of the use of physical force. But the means of coercion proposed by the Frankfurt Rabbinate was confirmed by many others, for instance, Rabbi Jacob Ettlinger of Altona, Nathan Adler in Hanover, the future chief rabbi of the United Kingdom, as well as less famous luminaries. So the difference is only physical force or appealing to the government. This stance, however, was not adopted by all the respondents. Among them were some who were inclined to more or less radical reform. Outstanding among them was Samuel Hirsch, then rabbi in Luxembourg, later in the United States. He too affirms the obligatory character of circumcision based on philosophical considerations, hoping that this would convince the objectors to reconsider their view. He simply ignored the question of what should be done with those who would not. Isaac Noach Mannheimer, the modern preacher of Vienna and a lenient reformer, spoke out very strongly against the deviators, declaring that he would never admit an uncircumcised boy to bar mitzvah or even grant him a Jewish burial. Still, the disciplinary measures to be taken against him would remain within Jewish society and its institutions. The proposed appeal to the state authorities, as mentioned by the Frankfurter, however, he rejected with his argument that, I quote, "For this we have too much self-esteem." A similar attitude was assumed by Shmuel David Lutato of Padua and by Shlomo Rapoport of Prague, both more famous as critical scholars than as halakhists. That the reformers and the critical scholars rejected appeal to the non-Jewish authorities does not come as a surprise. It is more astonishing to see the same attitude to be taken by Samson Raphael Hirsch, at that time rabbi in Emden. Hirsch avoided mentioning the possible assistance of the non-Jewish authorities, instead advising Rabbi Trier only to declare the reluctant father to be a mumar who had willfully severed his ties with the Jewish community. And now a sentence of Hirsch. Thus, he concluded, "You have on your part completed the lofty task of your office, and all beyond it lies with God." That is the end of the sentence. This was, of course, a polite but clear disassociation from the stratagem of the Frankfurt Rabbinate. The rabbis submitted their answer to the Frankfurt inquiry ostensibly as halakhic experts, yet their responses contained very little halakhic substance. This was for good reasons, as their decision, namely the exclusion of the father from the Jewish fold because of his refusal to circumcise his son, was not easy to justify in halakhic terms. Though theologically of special significance, the father's duty to circumcise his son is formally on the same level as eating matzah on the first night of Pesach, taking tzedulah on Sukkot, or for that matter, putting on tefillin every weekday. Thousands of Jews had by that time, of course, neglected the observance of these positive commandments without incurring any punitive measures on the part of the rabbis. The exceptional severity of the omission of the circumcision, eliciting the punishment of karet, that is heavenly decree shortening of life, concerns the uncircumcised son as an adult, who, also aware of being uncircumcised, does not fulfill the commandment himself, that is well known. Yet the subject of the deliberation was, for the time being, not the son, but the father, whose condemnation could not formally rest on the exceptional severity connected with courage. Indeed, the verdict of Rabbi Trier regarding the reluctant father was not based on the bare fact of his non-fulfillment of the commandment, but on the assumption that he was motivated by a denial of the biblical obligation, making him a heretic and apikoros, indeed. Most of the respondents then dwelt on this aspect of the transgression, giving the issue a theological slant rather than a halakhic one. True, the exclusion of transgressors, if their transgression was motivated by heretic intentions, could be supported by quotations from Maimonides. And one respondent, Jakob Hirsch Mecklenburg, the author of Octavia Kabbalah, did just in his response, written in Hebrew, just this, based on this. Still, even he, like most of the respondents, was in fact prompted by the exceptional status of circumcision in the public mind, rather than by its formal definition as a positive command. Interestingly enough, Mecklenburg cited, in addition to the halakhic arguments, a biblical reference supporting the exclusion of the uncircumcised from the Jewish fold. The wording of the Torah in Venikrata Hanefesh Ahu Me'amot, according to the tradition, refers to karet, that is heavenly punishment, but its plain meaning indicates, according to him, that he be expelled from the midst of his people. Mecklenburg thus hit on an interpretation of the 12th century commentator Yosef the Horshol, at that time unknown, which is, by the way, also held by some modern exegetes. That he was keen to adduce additional proof to his halakhic argumentation is a sign of the weakened position halakhists as such could claim for their authority. Let us now return to the question of how the Hamburg rabbis could have hoped in 1819 to harness the non-Jewish authorities into helping them in their struggle against the Reformed Temple, when such help, except concerning circumcision, already had been denied them. The answer, however, lies precisely in the circumcision case. It shows that the reluctance, though reluctant to enforce religious law in its entirety, the non-Jewish authorities were not indifferent to the Jews' attitude to their own religion. Jewish religion, having been practiced in European countries since the early Middle Ages, enjoyed an acknowledged status. It was regarded, as we know, as a kind of predecessor of Christianity, and as such it retained its raison d'etre. If it could have been demonstrated that the temple deviated from the basic tenets and practices of Judaism, it would have lost its justification, and its adherents would have been exposed as people without a legally protected religion. Some perceptive respondents to the Hamburg query, especially the Chatam Sofer of Pressburg, realized the significance of this point. That is, why they stressed in their answers that the reformers, in deviating from Jewish teachings and practices, had ceased to be Jews without becoming Christians. They were people with no religion, leaving the logical conclusion to the non-Jewish authorities that such people could not be tolerated in the country. As noted, the hope of the Hamburg inquiries as well as that of their respondents was fixed on the direct approach to the Hamburg Senate. It occurred to the inquiries that some outstanding rabbis, such as Chatam Sofer and his father-in-law, Rabbi Akiva Eger, would publish a denouncement of the temple. This would directly or indirectly influence the outcome of the Hamburg struggle. The same stratagem was suggested to the Chatam Sofer by the Sephardic rabbi of Trieste, Abraham Eliezer Halevi. The Chatam Sofer, however, declined, giving two reasons for his refusal. First, publicity would transform the issue into a public debate between the participating rabbis and the reformers. This could not fail to undermine the authority of the rabbis to lay down the law ex cathedra. Second, denouncement would mean publicly censoring and even cursing certain individuals coming close to the pen, the harem, that had been outlawed by the government of Austria. But Rabbi Halevi had another strategy. He had connections with the same famous Simon von Lemel from Prague and Vienna, who, because he had rendered important services to the Habsburg regime, had great influence at the Vienna court. Because Lemel was a devoted Orthodox Jew, Rabbi Halevi thought he would be prepared to intervene with the Kaiser to support the anti-reform party in Hamburg. He also asked the Chatam Sofer to approach other influential people capable of advancing this course of action. This stratagem conformed to the traditional methods of intervention with potentates in the interest of the Jewish community, and this is what they had in mind. Though giving it only a small chance of success, the Chatam Sofer was willing to lend a hand to Halevi's enterprise. He would try to enlist the help of some friends in Prague, and even his great intimate, Rabbi Ephraim Zalman Margoliot of Georgia. Nothing came out of this rather fantastic scheme. Indeed, the Chatam Sofer spoke about the possible exclusion of the reformers by a governmental fiat as a hypothetical instance only. This is obvious from the closing passage of his reply to Rabbi Halevi, stating what he would do to the reformed people if he had the power. And I'm quoting now his words. Where the verdict about them given into our hands, my intention would be to bar them from our domain, that no daughters of ours may be given to their sons and no sons of theirs to our daughters. Be their community as that of the Sadducees and the Karaites, they should keep among themselves and we among ourselves. End of quotation. This oft-quoted passage reveals the Chatam Sofer as a realist who recognized the fact that the rabbis were incapable of enforcing the law. They had lost their authority on two accounts. It was contested by both the Maskilim and the reformers, and it was essentially unsupported by the state. Yet, as happens sometimes with perceptive observers of a historical situation, Hatam Sofer, though correctly diagnosing his situation, did not draw the implied conclusion. He did not entirely give up the hope of being able to manage the situation through behind-the-scenes intervention and avoid confronting the opponent in public debate. This stance may have been influenced by his geographical location. Pressburg, though not unaffected by the emerging trend of Haskalah, was still situated at the margin of the main arena of modernization. The Hamburg rabbis, however, were at its center, and while they originally collected the rabbinical testimonies in order to influence the Senate, they also used it as a propaganda for the public. This is why they were published in the original Hebrew as well as in the German, the well-known book, Ere Divrei Habrit. The next generation acquiesced in the fact that the molding of the Jewish religion, with the possible exception of circumcision, had become an internal affair. Then, as a reaction to the Braunschweig Conference of Reform Rabbis in 1844, Zvi Hirsch Lehren of Amsterdam appealed to Orthodox rabbis all over Europe to condemn the new trend. He defined his main purpose as enlightening the Jewish public about the heretic tendencies involved in reform. He did refer to the non-Jewish origins, but not as a possible source of protection for Orthodox. On the contrary, he feared that some government, relying on the statements of the reformers, might impose unacceptable demands and changes on the observant community. The tenor of most of the respondents to the Lehren's appeal conformed to his request, their intention being to deny the authority of the reformers to speak out in the name of the Jewish religion. Only responses coming from Galicia mentioned the possibility of appealing to governments to suppress the reform as a deviating sect. In Galicia, they were not yet aware about the real situation in the West. In the West, by then, including Hungary as well, Orthodox rabbis realized the hopelessness of such an expectation. This is clearly documented in the reaction of Rabbi Moshe Schick, the Maram Schick, to the news of the Braunschweig Conference. A comparatively young rabbi serving in a small community near Pressburg, he appears not to have been approached by their still. Having read the protocols of the conference, he reflected on what could be done to meet the danger of reform. He submitted his idea to the rabbi of Pressburg at the time, Zaktav Sofer, who, though even younger than he, was supposed to have greater authority due to his lofty position and his being the son of Katan Sofer. Schick took it for granted and said so in so many words, that the non-Jewish authorities would not permit the banning of the deviators as required by Jewish law, but nothing would prevent the rabbis from publishing their authoritative view on what the banning would imply, namely, a denial of the reformers' right to be called Jews, and therefore to take part in any Jewish ritual, to serve as a rabbi or teachers, or appear as witnesses before Jewish courts. Observant Jews would then know how to behave towards the reformers, refraining from social contact and intermarriage with them. Maram Schick thus conceded expressis verbis that suppression of the deviators was no viable option under the circumstances. What the Orthodox could do was dissociate themselves from the reformers, and that is what he sought to impress upon them as a halakhic religious duty. This tendency later received organizational expression after the full emancipation of Hungarian Jewry in 1867, when the opportunity arose to establish an independent nationwide Orthodox association. Rabbi Schiff, having in the meantime been appointed to the important rabbinical seat of Fuss and become a celebrity, had a leading role in the establishment of such an organization. His concept then achieved practical realization. The resignation of Orthodoxy to its status as a minority also led to important shifts in its ideological presentation. Having lost the ability to enforce the law, the rabbis could no longer simply state their halakhic views. They had to defend them ideologically, underpinning the whole edifice of the Orthodox tradition, all its dogmatic and practical details. Special attention was paid to practices attacked or even abolished by the reformers. This was not always an easy task, for many a custom to which Orthodoxy adhered out of pure conservatism did not halakhically rest on sure ground. Thus, even during the Hamburg controversy, some of the participants made great efforts to find reasons why prayer should not be said in the vernacular in the face of the explicit permission found in the Mishnah. Extreme conservatism prevailed in Hungarian Orthodoxy. Reform was here very restrained, attempting only slight changes in public worship, such as moving the Almemer, the Bima, to the Aron HaKodesh, or solemnizing the Kuppah in the synagogue. To rationalize these customs, one of the exponents of Orthodoxy, Israel David Yapamar Berliot, a friend and intimate of Rabbi Schick, published a full treatise contriving halakhic as well as quasi-philosophical justification for their preservation. In another booklet, he defended the continuing obligation of observing the second day of the festivals, adducing reasons mentioned neither in the Talmud nor in later halakhic literature. In his defense of the second day, Yapamar Berliot was not alone, for this observance became a major issue among traditionalists and would-be innovators all over Europe. The controversy began even in the lifetime of Hakam Sofer. In one of his responses in 1831, he justified a stringent decision concerning the second day in the Aliyah with the observation, I quote, that violators of the law among us deride the second day, saying it is no more than a custom, a minhag. To meet the challenge, he preferred a halakhic reason, turning the second day into a quasi-biblical obligation, Isur Doraita. He declared that the custom had acquired the nature of a collective vow, which could not be nullified under any circumstances. He also suggested a rather metaphysical grounding, quoting a Talmudic source, according to which any decree of the Talmudic sages receives heavenly sanction, compelling even nature to accommodate it. This, of course, went far beyond the Talmudic report that observance of the second day arose from the doubt in the diaspora concerning the date of the appearance of the human in Jerusalem and Min Hagavot, and no more. The Talmud indeed referred to the second day as a custom of our ancestors, but according to Rashi's reading, another reason played a part in the preservation of the additional day after the introduction of the permanent calendar. This additional reason was the fear of suppression of Torah study by the inimical government, in the wake of which doubts as to the date of the festival might once again be possible. Such a contingency, being highly improbable in modern times, the would-be innovators had an excellent case with which they could effect the continuation of this observance. With the emergence of modern economic conditions, the loss of time incurred by the double festivals added to the motivation for the revolution. Indeed, such attempts occurred in Germany, in England, and even in Italy, where a group of rich merchants approached the rabbi of Mantua in 1854, asking their permission for business to be conducted on these days, otherwise they would take the law into their own hands. The request of the businessmen was supported, according to the report of the local rabbis, by some learned halakhists. The local rabbi then resorted to the time-honored stratagem of appealing to the halakhic experts in Europe, as well in the land of Israel, to confirm their refusal to accede to the innovative request. The traditionalists were especially hard-pressed in this case. The formal reason for retaining the second day of the festival was indeed so weak that it could hardly be presented as a convincing justification of the burdensome practice. Rabbi Joshua Margaliot, whom I mentioned earlier, believed that the real reason for the second day was that the new moon appears later outside the land of Israel than in Jerusalem, and so the real festival in the diaspora is in fact only the second day. Even more fantastic was the explanation of the Reverend Simonson from Birmingham in England, who believed he had found indications in the biblical text concerning the festival that observance outside the land of Israel had to be simultaneous with that of its inhabitants. This was only made possible, he said, by adding the second day. Simonson was prompted to invent the biblical reason for the second day because the Reform Synagogue in London had abolished its observance, not in view of the disputability of the Talmudic reasoning as in most other places it has been argued, but as a consequence of the leaders' rejection of the oral law altogether. He thus tried to meet their objections on their own ground. An otherwise unknown person, his fanciful interpretation would not have received much attention. The fact is, however, that the renowned chief rabbi of England, Nathan Adler, adopted Simonson's theory in one of his sermons, no doubt for similar apologetic reasons. He may have regretted this later, for his sermon elicited a most severe attack from an anonymous writer in the Jewish Chronicle. Now, that is a very special case of England, where indeed the reformers were more radical than in Germany, because there indeed, as some of the scholars pointed out, a colorite a real Karaite community arose. And the argument therefore was different than in Germany or in Italy, where they tried to justify the abolition of second day on the basis of the weak argument in the Talmud. Surveying what I have said until now, it turns out that the rabbis in the early decades, after the modernity, were in a very difficult situation. Their predicament is not to be judged, of course, by comparison with later days. They tried to defend the tradition by bits and pieces of inventions. It is an exception of Samson Raphael Hirsch, who realized the situation and evolved a system of justification. So this system is of course very much individual and certainly would not stand up to philosophical criticism, but it fulfilled at that time a certain function. His own attempt, as well as the attempt of the other rabbis, anyhow indicate what the situation was. It was a time of embarrassment where the anarchists lost the ground on which they used to act and teach, and had to grapple with the new situation as well as they could. Thank you very much.
The profound format of the question that was with people standing their feet up front, there's really no need.